From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about your midlife crisis. You remember that feeling of malaise and discontentment you felt right around your 40s? The journalist Jonathan Rauch says it's not really a crisis, it's a slump, and it's completely normal. Rauch's book is actually about all the stages in the happiness curve and why life gets better after you turn 50. We'll be right back.
With the KUER app, you'll never have to choose between Doug Fabrizio and a phone call from your spouse. Just hit the pause button and take the call. When you're ready, hit play and it's back to Radio West. The KUER app lets you pause whatever you're listening to, and you can get a constant feed of BBC News and classical music with our other streams, BBC on KUER and KUER Classical. It's even got an alarm clock, so you can wake up with Diane Mechapinto's Moon Report and Morning Edition. Download the KUER app for iPhone and Android today. It'll help you be a better partner.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Not everyone is the same, of course, but if you were to track your life on a graph and take measurements of when you were happy and when you weren't, almost all of us would end up with a U-shaped curve. Call it the happiness curve. That's the name of the journalist Jonathan Rauch's new book. And in it, he helps us understand why we're happy at certain moments of our life and why we're not. As you know, we're often not all that happy at middle age. That's the trough in the curve. And some of that is the stress of your job and dealing with your kids or taking care of your aging parents. But even if you took out all of that stuff, the stress, the teenagers, Rauch says you would still hit a midlife funk. We all do. This is natural. Jonathan Rauch is a journalist and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. It's a think tank in Washington, D.C. He's the author of a number of books, many articles on public policy and culture and government. His latest book is called The Happiness Curve: Why Life Gets Better After 50. Rauch's book explores what we're learning about happiness. He says we're used to thinking of a midlife crisis as just something that happens to us. But he says he's discovered what's really going on is that this isn't just about individuals going through all of this. It's about all of us together going through it.
We have this social story we tell that we're supposed to be on the top of our game. You know, at age 45 and 50, we're taking care of the kids and taking care of the parents and at the peak of our careers, and so supposed to be, you know, we're healthy, we're peak earning years. So we're not supposed to be disappointed and vulnerable and going through a difficult emotional transition. And that means people aren't getting help with this. And it means people who are in a state of dissatisfaction and transition get isolated. They feel ashamed. It's like, I'm gay too. And it was like actually being in the closet because you feel ashamed. And that's a social phenomenon.
Yeah.
That's society not coping with the reality of adult development.
I want to ask you about Thomas Cole and these four paintings, The Voyage of Life. Maybe explain when you first saw them. This was at the National Gallery in D.C. You were a sophomore in college, and you were really kind of captivated by them.
I was in my first visit to the National Gallery, first visit actually as a grown-up to D.C., and I turn the corner, and there are these four huge paintings by Thomas Cole, a great American landscape painter. They're painted in about 1840, and there are four of them, and they're a series showing a voyager on the river of time. Starts with childhood and then youth, manhood, which is really middle age, and then old age. Captivating paintings that show the psychological journey of age. And this is years before the word psychology had even been invented.
Yeah.
But what Cole shows here is that at the age of about 20, which is where I was, it shows a youth on a boat in the river. That's time reaching toward a castle in the sky. But what we can see, that the young man in the boat, Canatus, that the river is going to turn away from the castle in the sky. He's not going to achieve that satisfaction. The next painting, Manhood, shows now the middle-aged man in the boat on the rapids, heavy rocks, storms, rain, and he's praying because he's lost the tiller to his boat. And I remember thinking at age 20, okay, well, youth is certainly me. I had big ambitions.
Yeah.
But that manhood thing, that'll never happen to me. If I have any success at all in life, if I get anywhere, I know I'll be grateful and happy in middle age.
Right.
And of course, that's not how it worked out.
Yeah. It's interesting you say around that time when you saw those paintings that you made this vow. You didn't want to get to that point, right? And so you decided, and I'm guessing you still do this, that you would take time to appreciate the blessings that would come your way.
I was counting my blessings. Yeah, I started noticing this persistent sense of irrational dissatisfaction in my late 30s. And I didn't know where it was coming from because I was achieving my goals. I was doing better than achieving my goals. Plus, I was in a stable relationship and I was physically healthy and I had plenty of income. And so I had all these reasons to be grateful. And increasingly, I was finding I was preoccupied with this sense that I was trapped in a life that was disappointing and underachieving. So I would sit down around the time of my 40th birthday, and I actually made a list in my diary. I reprint it in the book. A little embarrassing. So one reviewer described it as toe curling. But in any case, I was brutally candid. I listed all the things I had to be grateful for.
Yep.
But as my 40s went on, I found that actually didn't help because it was just reminding me that I wasn't grateful enough.
Yeah. What I think is so interesting about that, and this is crucial because I think we're all going to be able to relate to this. Like, what is wrong with me? Because I'm doing okay, and most of us probably can say that, not everyone, of course, but that sense of ingratitude, that embarrassment, as you put it,
mm-hmm.
of that dissatisfaction, what's happening there?
So there's something called a U-shaped happiness curve.
Yep.
It's observed in humans and in chimps and orangutans, so it seems to be pretty fundamental. And what it finds is that it's harder to be satisfied with our overall lives in the middle of life than at the beginning or the end. It's this dip in the middle. That's the U shape.
Yeah.
We're talking about life satisfaction. That is, how do you feel about your life as a whole, not about, you know, your mood on any given day? Well, part of what's going on there, to go back to Cole's painting, is you remember that castle in the sky that the young man is reaching for. So it turns out he's not just reaching for worldly and material success, though he does want that. He's also reaching for the happiness that he expects to get from worldly and material success,
yeah.
his future life satisfaction. But here's the thing. When we're young and ambitious, ambition keeps us going by promising a huge amount of happiness and satisfaction if we, you know, we get that great job and we have that great marriage and the house and the income and whatever.
Yeah.
But ambition is a trickster. It's a hamster wheel. It keeps moving the goalposts.
Yeah.
That's the whole point of ambition, right? It's to keep us motivated.
Right.
If we stop, then ambition is not doing its job. After 15 or 20 years of achieving all this external success, which many of us do, and not experiencing the happiness we expect, we become disappointed in how happy we are and pessimistic. We start to feel by my mid-40s that, okay, this is the new me.
Yeah.
I will never be satisfied with my life because this can go on. It becomes self-feeding. You become alarmed that you don't seem to have the capacity to be satisfied and you don't know what to do about it. You become isolated because you're not telling people, and all of those things feed back in, and it becomes a spiral. And this is midlife trough. And there's like actual economists and psychologists have done the math on this and shown how this can – midlife crisis is often literally about nothing. It's a transition in our brains as our values shift, and it's also this self-feeding as we amplify unhappiness. That doesn't make it, however, any less real as a subjective feeling.
you dig into this happiness curve and how it was discovered. And as you point out, it turns out no one was actually looking for it. I guess they just sort of stumble upon the happiness curve.
Yeah, in fact, the idea of midlife crisis comes along in the mid-1960s and then gets popular currency when Gail Sheehy's book Passages, an admirable book. And then psychologists come along and they look for midlife crisis and no one ever finds it. And the psychological profession says, you know what, it's a myth. And they all move on in the 80s. Meanwhile, in the 90s, some economists begin looking at these huge data sets, countries all over the world, millions of data points on life satisfaction. These polls are conducted actually on a daily basis by Gallup and others. So the amount of data is vast. And then they do what statisticians do. They start looking for the effect of, you know, income, marriage, employment, to try to figure out what makes people happy.
Right.
And then they take all those things out of the equation, expecting to find nothing left. But there's this weird thing that they keep stumbling upon and it won't go away. And that's that there's an effect of time all by itself on happiness, independent of all these other things going on. It's not the only thing, but it's significant and it's U-shaped. Aging process militates against life satisfaction till about the age of 50 in the U.S., and then it switches sides and it militates for happiness. None of us see that coming, but this is what aging itself is actually doing. And this just fell out of the data. For a while, people kind of ignored it because it's, you know, okay, well, quirky. But then some people in the late 90s, early 2000s started to focus on it. Then it was found in chimps and orangutans. Mm-hmm. And then people realized they had stumbled upon a major discovery. The time is not neutral where happiness is concerned. It works against us in midlife.
Time matters is a really crucial point in the book.
Time matters. Age matters, and not the way most people think. Most people think, yeah, sure, age matters. That's because you get old and then things get miserable. So youth is exciting, and then midlife is, you know, you've got some issues to deal with, and then, of course, old age is a calamity. Mm-hmm. None of that is true.
There was this big question as soon as people start noticing this U-shaped pattern. There's the question of whether, is this cultural? Is this biological? And what they found is, of course—
The answer is yes.
The answer is yes to both of those. What they found in primates, as you kind of referred to, I wanted to ask you about. Because you say this ape study finally, as you put it in the book, riveted your attention to this happiness curve. Talk a little bit about that and why it is that you found that so interesting.
Well, happiness curve literature comes out of economics. These are not psychologists.
Yeah.
And no one was really sure what they were looking at because the what now is pretty clear. It's been demonstrated in countries and cultures all over the world. The shape, the specific shape of the U will change. You know, where it bottoms out tends to bottom out earlier in poorer countries and that sort of thing will change. But the basic pattern just turns up all over the place.
Right.
But economists couldn't explain this, and they would keep writing, well, someone in psychology will have to figure this out someday. It only began to really dawn on people that this was probably something pretty fundamental about human wiring in 2012 when an economist named Andrew Oswald emailed a primatologist named Alexander Weiss in Scotland and said, hey, you've got populations of chimps and orangutans. Why don't you look at their emotional well-being over their lifespan? And sure enough, when they look at it, same pattern among chimps and orangutans, midlife decline in happiness. And light bulb kind of goes on and says, okay, something pretty basic is happening here. This probably is just more than a statistical artifact. And then a lot of other stuff began to come out. The problem, the deaths of despair problem in America, that's opioids and suicide and that kind of thing. Those are disproportionately concentrated in middle age. Middle age has higher suicide rates. It's got higher depression rates. It turns out that middle age is a highly vulnerable part of life.
Yeah.
And then psychologists got in, and now we have some, I think we have some pretty decent ideas about what's going on here.
I like the analogy to a river. Happiness curve is, you describe it as having this kind of undertow that pulls against you in middle age. And you can get through it. I mean, we can row through it, but it's just more difficult.
Yeah, the river metaphor was really helpful for me. I pick it up from Thomas Cole, who's got it in these paintings. Right. It turns out, you know, he was 160 years ahead of his time in what he was doing. But it's important to remember, it's not foreordained that Doug Fabrizio is going to be unhappy in his 40s, because there's lots of other things going on, like whether you get the Nobel Prize or a cancer diagnosis or the death of a child, all of these things will have huge impacts on your sense of well-being. So what you have to think about is age is like the current in the river. Lots of other things determine what your journey will be like for any individual. What's the condition of your boat? How good are you at steering and rowing? How healthy are you? What kind of storms do you hit along the way? And so forth and so on. All of those things matter. But if those other things are pretty stable, and for a lot of high achievers, they are pretty stable, you know, there are occasional crises, but they pass, then you really feel the current in the river. And it's pulling against you in middle age. And you don't know what's going on. Why is it so much harder to get where I'm going now? And then it turns around just as unexpectedly. So what we're not saying here is that everyone is destined to follow the same emotional pattern through their lives. What we're saying is that other things being equal, it is harder to be satisfied with your life in midlife. And it's not for any particular reason. It's probably not your job or your marriage.
Jonathan Rauch. His book is The Happiness Curve, Why Life Gets Better After 50. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
KUER's community of sustainers do so much for the station. Because of their ongoing contributions, we're able to bring you award-winning local news, NPR coverage, Radio West, and our own podcasts. Starting at $5 a month, you can be a sustainer too. Then, next time you hear a story you love, you'll know you made it happen. Become a sustainer at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the journalist Jonathan Rauch to help us understand our midlife crisis. Rauch says this is a healthy process that actually equips us for the next stage in our life. His book is called The Happiness Curve, Why Life Gets Better After 50. I think one of the really beautiful parts about the book that you've written are the stories that you tell throughout. And I wanted to ask you about the conversations that you've had along the way. It seems like dozens and dozens, maybe hundreds. And I want to ask you about the questionnaire that you gave people, because you asked them to rate their life satisfaction in each decade of their lives on this scale, and then to give a few words or phrases to describe that. Talk a little bit about that process, the interviewing process, and how you made this assessment of how people were thinking about where they thought they might be in their lives.
So there are two contributions that I can modestly say that my book is making, apart from the big contribution, which is telling people all the stuff I wish I could have known when I was 39 and entering this current. One is that it brings together three strands of research from economics, psychology, and brain science. The second is I brought in tons of human voices. Yeah. To get under the data, and that's something that economists working with giant data sets can't do. So lots of texture of individual lives. And the way I did that was I developed a very simple 5-minute questionnaire. You can take it. It's on my book website, happinesscurvebook.com. And I asked people to give a numerical rating from 1 to 10 of their life satisfaction in each decade of life up to then, and also to give me three adjectives to describe each decade. It's not super scientific, but that's not the point, because what I would do, I used it as a screening device, and then I would interview the people who took it and try to understand why, for example, the guy I begin the book with, a man named Carl, was 45 at the time and in a situation much like me when I was at 45. I'm 10 years older than he is. But one of the words he used was scared. Now, this is someone who was doing great. He had a new job, which he liked, and he was doing what he'd always wanted to do, and he had a good marriage, and he had two kids, and everything seemed to be going fine. And I said, scared of what? And it turned out he was scared because he was experiencing this emotional turmoil about his own sense of unfulfillment. Yeah. He'd come home every night from work and think, this again? I'm so tired of this. There must be something better in life. But he knew this was irrational. He had become scared that he was kind of losing his mind, that there was something wrong with him psychologically. And I hit that again and again, and I also hit that in myself. There's something wrong with me. That's the kind of stuff you get from talking to actual people about how they experience it. And it's part of what convinced me to go back to your very first point. This is a social problem. We've got to get much better at connecting with people who are going through a midlife slump, not making fun of them. Oh, Carl, you must be having your midlife crisis. When are you going to buy that convertible?
Right.
This is so not helpful.
Yeah. Let's talk about Dominic as a contrast. He's not so far past age-wise, Carl. Dominic's 50. Similar in the sense of successful, professional, similar path to Carl's in some ways. But
we actually travel in the same social circles. Right. So they're a matched pair.
Yeah, matched pair. And where he's ended up is interesting. The word that he uses to characterize his life is appreciative. Explain that, because you asked him, what is it that brought about, as you put it, this kind of rebirth of gratitude? Expecting less and appreciating more, I think, is how he described it.
Yeah, that was a wonderful phrase when I asked. He was someone also who in his mid-40s had been in a situation similar to Carl's. He experienced this sense of this, I call it the fog of disappointment, pervasive sense that he was underachieving. His life was unsatisfied and he was trapped in it, all very common things. And I said, what changed? And he said, well, I guess I'm expecting less and appreciating more. But then I pushed him harder. I said, yeah, but why?
Yeah.
And he didn't really know why. He just said that's kind of what had happened. And I think I know why. I think it's because his values were changing and his brain was changing in a way that's pretty fundamentally wired into our evolutionary structure. But when we go through it, of course, we don't have insight into what our brain is doing. It's just doing it. But the main difference between him and Carl is Dominic is 5 or 6 years further along the happiness curve, and he's probably bottomed out, and he's probably started on the upslope, where all the disappointing surprises of not being happy as you expected turn around into pleasant surprises in the later decades of life.
I want to talk about this interesting Princeton economist, Hannes Schwant, because the insights that he comes to about well-being, I think, are interesting. And you kind of profile him, this young German economist. Tell us a little bit about him, because his story is interesting, first of all. He thinks about quitting economics. It's not really giving him what he's maybe hoping for. And then he strikes on this idea of happiness, and he really takes off.
Yeah. Hannes Schwant, now at University of Zurich, when I met him and when he did this work, I think was barely 30s, probably about 31. He's one of these people who get into economics who's perfectly good at math but wants to do real-world stuff. And he gets interested in happiness economics. Well, this is now a flourishing branch of economics, but it's very much a minority taste because, most economists want to look at stuff like monetary policy or whatever. They want to look at statistics.
Yeah.
Happiness economists are saying, hey, wait a minute, guys. None of that matters really except insofar as we're increasing people's well-being in life. If we're not doing that, then really what's the point of growing GDP? And in fact, in America, GDP has more or less tripled since the 1950s. Happiness has not risen at all, may have declined a bit.
Yeah.
something's very wrong with this picture. So happiness economists started studying it. Hanna started studying it. He soon hit what a lot of people hit, which is a lot of economists say, well, that's not real economics. You should be a psychologist.
Right.
But he persists with this work. He's the guy who figures out, he looks at some data sets, and he figures out that you and I mispredict our future happiness. Well, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Well, it means that I assume 5 years from now, my happiness is going to be 8 on a scale of 1 to 10. And when I get there, it turns out to be 7. And then I make the same mistake every year. So year after year, I'm disappointed in how happy I am.
Yeah.
And that's the cycle that leads, by the time you're in your late 30s and early 40s, to this sense of pervasive disappointment. But he also finds that as we go through this process of being perpetually disappointed in how happy we are, we readjust our expectations for the future. We become more realistic about our future happiness. Well, that sounds depressing, and it kind of is, but it has this side effect, which is really positive. By the time we get to our early 50s, we're realistic about our future happiness,
yeah,
which means we stop being disappointed. Meanwhile, this U curve turns around for reasons we can discuss. It's more positive, where we tend to be happier as we age. And so suddenly, with our expectations realistic and our actual happiness exceeding our expectations, this negative spiral of constant disappointment becomes a positive cycle of pleasant surprises that go on right through our 80s. And that's the happiness U curve in a nutshell.
Yeah.
Years of disappointment followed by years of pleasant surprises.
And that one of the big questions you really get at is why we're forecasting our happiness wrong. And it turns out that the errors are wired in us, as you say. They're kind of baked in. In other words, it's biological. You talk with Jonathan Haidt. He helped you put it in perspective. Basically, he says that these gut feelings have a powerful influence on our sense of reason. And he describes this as comparing it to riding an elephant. And the elephant metaphor was really helpful for me to understand this part. Take us through this part.
We imagine that as rational beings, we should respond rationally to, you know, our circumstances. And if our circumstances are good, then we'll be happy, right?
Yeah.
Obvious,
yeah.
Except that's not how it works. What Haidt is saying is that our life satisfaction and indeed even our opinions are shaped by intuition, stuff that happens deep inside us. And then appears in our mind. He calls that the elephant. And he says the rational mind is like the rider of an elephant. It's sitting on top. And if the rider and the elephant agree on what direction they want to go, fine. But if they disagree, the elephant's going to win. And the rider's going to have to follow on top of the elephant, sitting there rationalizing whatever the elephant is doing and often being mystified by it.
Yeah.
And his point about that in his book, The Happiness Hypothesis, which I would recommend everyone read, is the way you deal with that is by trying to avoid these situations where the rider and the elephant are going in different directions, where our rational values and our intuitive values are in conflict. And that actually tends to happen a lot in middle age because our intuitive values are still wanted, you know, I want ambition, I want more than I've got. And our rational values are saying, well, wait, you should be grateful.
Yeah, yeah.
And that creates this big tension.
Yeah.
So that's the metaphor of the elephant. And then there's also this separately, there's been good psychological research on so-called optimism bias. It turns out that most people are unreasonably optimistic about their lives. And if they weren't, they wouldn't get out of bed in the morning because
right.
They'd have what's called depressive realism. Turns out mildly depressed people actually have make the best predictions of how things will turn out. But who wants to be mildly depressed?
Right. I have to say, the one part about the elephant thing, Haidt told you that it's not the elephant's mission to make us satisfied. The elephant wants us to pass on our genes. right? And so it means that – and that what that means is you need to get prestige. You need to be attractive and you need to be successful. So the elephant doesn't really care if we're particularly happy. I mean, that's this strong biological urge. That's why we feel so dissatisfied in that slump, right?
That's it. That's exactly right. You put it at least as well as I could have done. The elephant wants ambition. The elephant is socially ambitious. It wants prestige and status and reputation. It wants to accumulate as much of those things as it can because then it's going to have more mating opportunities, and that's what evolution really cares about. Are we happy with that? Well, actually, as we discussed earlier, ambition is very disappointing. It's a hamster wheel. It gives us what's called the hedonic treadmill, where the harder you run, you know, you don't actually feel any happier. You just keep running harder. But evolution doesn't care about that. It wants us to run hard.
Yeah.
That's fine with it. You know, does it care if ants are happy, if fleas are happy, if humans are happy? Not really. But our rational minds say, hey, I'm doing all this great stuff. I should be happy.
Yeah. Let's talk about when we get out of the rapids. Margaret is an Australian woman that you talked to. She was in her 50s. And she talks about the sort of trajectory of her life. And there's this in her 40s, she's unsettled and restless, just like you were, just like I was. And then she starts to come out of it and she says she feels, here's the word, settled. Explain what she means by settled, because you could look at settled as, oh, she's just sort of settled with the sort of mediocre life that she's living. But it's not exactly what she meant. She's just become more, I guess, realistic.
This is one of the most interesting discoveries for me personally in the journey of writing this book. We talked about depressive realism, of when people have a better sense of what their actual happiness will be. And we talked about this readjustment that goes on through midlife as people squeeze out their excessive expectations of future happiness, which is what makes the disappointment go away. To me, on paper, that sounds depressing. That sounds like losing hope and just settling for less in life.
Yeah.
When I talk to people who've been around the happiness curve, like Margaret and like many others in the book, it turns out that's not at all what people are experiencing subjectively.
Yeah.
They're experiencing a sense of freedom that Jonathan Haidt likens to dropping a heavy backpack. All these super high expectations of ourselves for our happiness and our social achievement are burdens because we can never meet them. And as we age past them, people sense not that they're giving up on life, but that they're better able of savoring the smaller but more important things in life, things like the key relationships, things that can be simple and seem unsatisfying when you're younger, like having, in Margaret's case, learning crafts and making beautiful things. Young Margaret would have said, well, that's a waste of my time. You know, she's in media, Margaret. You know, I should be host of my own talk show in Salt Lake City.
Yeah.
But as she ages, she realized, no, there's more meaning than I ever understood in doing things that are important to me and just rewarding in their own right and being with the people I care about most. So what people experience is not like settling for something in the sense of giving up. It's a sense of feeling more settled, feeling better adjusted to the realities of their lives and finding additional depth. There's one person I interviewed, I call her Carla in the book, who said something early in my research which stuck with me because it's so important. She said, this is someone in her 50s. She said, I'm doing all the same things that I did in my 40s, but they feel different now. And that's exactly what it is.
I love the story you tell of this woman, Laura Carstensen. She's at Stanford Center on Longevity. She's 64 now, and you asked her about why is it that She had gone through the rapids. She'd come through all of this, but she's still engaged in this academic environment. So why isn't she more stressed about that? Because there are still grants, there's still peer competition, there's still critiques and all of that. And you asked her, why don't you feel so stressed? And I think her answer was really interesting. Would you talk about that?
This is someone, one of America's leading psychologists, huge achiever, but she came from a background of a rebellious youth and wasn't good in school and had a bit of a chip on her shoulders. And she describes her 40s as a time of enormous stress because she felt she was just under this huge pressure all the time to perform. And even after she got tenure, she felt like if she slowed down or got off her game at all, people would judge her. And the context here is I said to her, well, you're still doing all the same things. You've got even more commitments now. She's the founding director of the Stanford Center on Longevity. She's world famous, gives TED Talks. What about all that stress and pressure? And she said, she gave me a 6-word answer. She said, I don't care. I don't care. Now, she went on to make sure to convey to me she didn't mean she doesn't care about other people or her reputation. But she no longer feels that she has to go through life checking all of these boxes of other people's expectations, that she can focus more on doing the work she wants to do because it's important to her. And that, of course, is the same change that we talked about earlier in the case of Margaret. It's the same process of finding additional depth in the things you care about and being less oriented to checking off all of those social to-do list boxes. And that's a change going on in ourselves. That's adult development process. Yeah. It works. It used to be thought that adult development didn't really exist because, you get to age 20 or 21 and your brain is fully formed. And then adult development consists of getting old and dying. Turns out that's completely wrong.
Yeah.
We continue to develop and change right through the end of life in ways that have profound effects on us. And this is one of them.
Yeah. There's this reorienting of personal values away from ambition, you say, and toward connection. Again, getting us back to that theme, that this is social, this story. You write about Andrew Sullivan. Of course, he was a sensation with his blog. And then right in the middle of it, like when he seems like he couldn't get more popular, he walks away. And I think he's a good example of this. And you talked to him about that. What did he tell you?
Yeah, he's one of the few people I named because I was very careful to protect my interviewees' identities. But how do you protect someone who's a well-known legendary blogger?
Yeah.
So he consented to have his name being used. So I interviewed him sometime after he walked away from what I think is the most successful and best blog that was out there. And the reasons he gave, there are a bunch of reasons, and some of them are just personal stuff that are going on, and some of it is burnout. But he also said his values had changed, that he no longer cared as much about pursuing what he called glittery objects. And that being out there every day, making his opinions heard, just no longer seemed as important as it did. And he wanted to reinvest in his religious journey, in God, in the spiritual aspects of life. Now, all of this is exactly on track with what we know about the way our values change and the way our brains change as we age, which is, in fact, why he's the opening story in a chapter about wisdom.
Yep.
And the transformation that goes on in our values as we age.
Wisdom is not a word you would think of that would connect very well with a science like psychiatry. But you write about the importance of positive psychiatry and the importance of grafting into the science the idea of wisdom and these domains of wisdom. Talk a little bit about this part, because this is another critical part of the story.
Yeah, in a way, this material on wisdom is my favorite material in the book, and it's the one I get the least opportunity to talk about. But it's so important. if you look at George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, the greats from American statesmanship, you'll see the word wisdom again and again. It's invoked in speeches. For example, they'll say, "And may God give me the wisdom to help guide this country to safer shores." You look at the word wisdom today, and it's virtually out of circulation. It turns out I did a database search. When Donald Trump uses the word wisdom, which is rare, it's typically in the context of wise guy or wise ass. And the compliment you hear people give all the time is, "Doug Fabrizio, he's really smart." I mean, whoever says, "Doug Fabrizio, he's really wise." We just don't even think that way. We've lost wisdom as a cultural value. So here's the irony of that. While American culture's been busy losing track of wisdom and superseding it with being smart, clever, whatever, science has been rediscovering wisdom.
Yeah.
It turns out wisdom is a well-grounded scientific concept. You can measure it in psychometric tests. It is not the same as anything else. It's not even the same as a bunch of other things. It's not just having intelligence or experience or skill or any of those things. In fact, it's negatively correlated with intelligence.
Yeah.
It is wisdom and intelligence are very different. Intelligence, that's the rider on top of the horse. That's the ability to rationalize the situation for your advantage or maybe to analyze things. Wisdom is the ability to hold in your mind multiple values at once, to intuit how other people will see the situation, to rise above your immediate passions, all in order to help you and those around you navigate complex and treacherous social situations. And that seems to be why biology made this thing called wisdom. Mm. Wise people give good advice. Wisdom is contagious. And what they usually give advice about is, how should I deal with this or that tricky situation? Very valuable, very rare, something we've almost completely lost touch with.
Wisdom is balanced, you write. Wisdom is reflective. I love this. It's a package deal. And not only is it good for us individually, but coming back to the theme that we've been talking about throughout, it's good for us collectively. Again, this is good for all of us. It's social wisdom, I guess.
Yeah. Wisdom makes societies stronger because it's contagious, because people who are in wise thinking mode help those around us solve problems, typically in ways that avert conflicts, sometimes even war. They help us rise above our emotions. And at this point, it's still pretty conjectural because no one knows how to do a controlled experiment. But it looks like part of what's happening with the happiness curve is that humans, unlike any but three other species on the face of the planet, outlive our reproductive years by decades. Well, why would evolution keep us around after we're just physical objects that can't reproduce? The best hypothesis is the so-called grandmother hypothesis, which is that having elders in the tribe, those people help nurture the young and they also help the tribe and their relatives solve problems. Well, what are we talking about there? Wisdom. It may be that wisdom and the accumulation of the skills involved in wisdom over time is the whole reason that people live to ripe old age.
You mentioned that we need to make adjustments as we move into the new stage of adult development, and it's going to require some rethinking on some of these old patterns that we've seen in others, like our parents and our grandparents. Normalize, that's a one, and interrupt the internal critic. Maybe say something about those, if you would.
Normalize means understand if you're going through a midlife slump and you feel inexplicably trapped and frustrated. It's nothing wrong with you. You're going through a completely ordinary stage of adult development. In fact, you would be less healthy if you were not going through it.
Right.
So don't be like Carl, don't be scared.
Interrupt the internal critic.
part of what happens at this stage in life, certainly happened to me, is constant unwanted comparison of myself with others. Now, this is basically status anxiety, status obsession. Why am I not the host of a major Salt Lake City radio show? What's the matter with me? You know, telling myself that I actually never wanted to be the host of a major Salt Lake City radio show didn't help. It turns out that what can help is simple cognitive behavior therapy. And all that is basically interrupting these thought loops that we get in. And so I would just start saying when I started a comparison, like, why am I not? Yeah. I just interrupted in my brain. You try to learn to make this automatic. The phrase I used to interrupt was no comparison.
Yep.
And that was actually helpful. It doesn't solve the whole thing. I mean, the U-curve is basically there. But feeling like I was regaining some control over the internal critics that were carping away at me, that gave me some more confidence.
Well, not just say no comparison, shout no comparison in your mind.
Yeah, internally, shout it. But yeah. try to make it automatic.
Yeah.
Interrupt that loop.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Stay present.
Stay present. That's another big one. That's, of course, ancient wisdom.
Yep.
And it's true. The happiness curve, midlife malaise, is a time trap. We start thinking about all the disappointments in the past, the things we haven't achieved, the happiness we have not attained, and then we start thinking pessimistically about the future. Oh, you know, if it's been disappointing till right now, it's only going to get worse. Mm. Well, you escape that time trap, or try to, by being present. That gets easier as you get older, as we've said. But it's just a good thing, as the ancients have always said, to stay here and now, to focus on what's happening right now today, the good things, the bad things. But try not to let yourself get obsessed with the past and future and try to interrupt those thought patterns.
Mm-hmm. I love this one, share. Share is really important, I guess.
Yeah, that's the one I didn't do. I didn't even tell my husband that this was going on, because, you know, people don't want to be mocked and they don't want to alarm their families, their loved ones.
Yeah.
But isolation makes it worse. Isolation, keeping this all in, thinking I'm in the closet, I have to pretend to be strong every day, I can't tell anyone, and I've got a midlife malaise. I don't have midlife crisis. For most people, it's not a crisis. Mm-hmm. Crisis totally mischaracterizes it. Yeah. It's this fog of disappointment.
Yeah.
But no one wants people to say, I'm having my midlife crisis. So they keep it in, and isolation makes it much worse, as with anything else in life. So friends, counseling, coaching is a great thing to do. Helps us realign our values with our changing priorities in midlife. But don't bottle it up.
Step, don't leap. The idea of what? Patience, I suppose.
Yeah, strategic patience. Step, don't leap is important because the lesson here is not when you're in your 40s, never make a change. Because people need change in their 40s as they do at any other time of life. It's a question of how you do it.
Right.
If you've got a voice in you telling you throw the entire pack of cards up in the air, be disruptive, be impulsive, make a big change, flee, that voice is not your friend. That's your age talking. That's changes in your brain, which you're experiencing as these desires and impulses. If you make change, and you often should, it should be stepwise and continuous. You should build on your existing strengths and relationships and skills, not throw them away. Consult with others to make sure the change makes sense. Make sure there's a plan B if it doesn't work out. All of the things involved in rational planning of change are even more important in midlife.
I want to ask you finally, you mentioned in the book, look, self-help is good, but it's incomplete. And you say, in fact, what you probably figured out is that the answer is more external, that a large portion to these answers that we're trying to work out as we make this journey on this river is that they lie outside of ourselves. Again, this idea that this is about us.
This, to me, may be the most important concept in the book. The worst mistake we've made as a society in handling the emotional strains of midlife is turning it into a DIY project, asking people to cope with this on their own resources, or maybe, you know, as we discussed earlier, you go get a coach, but it's all on you. That's not how it should be. With adolescence, we all understand that for some people, not everyone, this will be a challenging time of life. And we surround people with institutions and resources and relationships that help them and guide them and buffer them to carry them through. We need to do much more of that around midlife. That would mean, for example, people talk about being able to take some of your Social Security payments 1 year worth early to go back to school and get retrained. Because people in midlife, what they're going through is a value shift.
Yeah.
And they want to do different things as they age. They want more focus on giving back. Help them do that. Internships for people in middle age. Gap years for people in middle age. Structures in education. Returning to school in workplaces like what people call not so hard jobs. That allow people channels through which to make this transition to the kind of life they're going to lead in their 60s and 70s. They need help with that. No one should have to go through that on their own. And I predict that in 20 or 30 years, those channels will be there. There will be tons of well-known social pathways guiding people through these shoals.
Jonathan Rauch, his book is The Happiness Curve, Why Life Gets Better After 50. He joined us from a studio at the Brookings Institution. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover, a program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Annie Lane Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.